So the focus of this talk, today's talk would be a critical system, a quantum critical system. And I will assume that there is a space rotational symmetry, so different directions in space are equivalent to each other. And for this type of quantum system, if we want to characterize quantum dynamics for this system, we know that we just need to look at mainly one quantity, the dynamic critical exponent z. For example, if we open Subir's book, Subir will tell us for a quantum critical point of this type, when we scale, when we do the scaling for this system, the space dimension and the time dimension, typically they scale sometimes the same way, sometimes differently. And this critical, dynamic critical exponent measures actually the dimension, the difference between the dimensions of space and time. So when space, when we rescale space by a factor lambda, typically we need to rescale time by a different factor, it's lambda to some other power, and that power is the z we define. So when z equals to 1, it recovers to the case where we are more familiar with and the more we are understood, because this system, when z equals 1, will have an emergent Lorentz and the conformal symmetry. And with Lorentz conformal and the conformal symmetry, these symmetries are very powerful. They are almost sufficient to fix everything. Okay? This symmetry enforces very strong constraints, almost many properties of physical observables actually are universally determined by just this symmetry. For example, if we consider a bosonic field, and assuming there is a real scalar boson, and compute the Green's function for this boson, by just looking at the Lorentz and the conformal symmetry, we can uniquely determine the functional form of this Green's function. It must be k squared minus omega to some power. And this power mu is actually the scaling dimension of the boson. So if we know the scaling dimension of boson, we know everything in this case. It's universally determined. But there are also quantum critical points with z larger than 1. And in this case, we still have scaling symmetry, but the Lorentz symmetry and the conformal symmetry is gone. Okay? Because the symmetry is dramatically lower, symmetry in this type of critical system typically is not strong enough to universally determine the functional form of physical observables. For example, if we look at the same type of Green's function, we consider a bosonic scalar phi with scaling dimension mu, same as what we considered above. We can immediately define another bosonic operator, which has exactly the same scaling dimension. Okay. This new bosonic operator is defined using the old bosonic operator multiplied by a dimensionless constant. And this dimensionless constant is an arbitrary function, and inside this function, omega squared over k to power 2z is a dimensionless quantity. It's invariant under scaling. Okay. With only scaling symmetry, this is allowed. That's very different from the z equals one case, where Lorentz symmetry says it's impossible to redefine your bosonic field. You have only one unique bosonic field in some sense. But here, we can redefine our bosonic field. We have two bosonic fields with the same scaling dimension. If we compute their Green's function, of course their Green's function are different, and different by the function f squared. Because f is arbitrary, it tells us if we know the scaling dimension, we can't uniquely determine the functional form. There is a huge degree of freedom here. Okay. So in condensed matter, strictly speaking, Lifshitz implies is used to refer to a specific type of z equals to 2 critical system. But today I will use it in a general sense to refer to any quantum critical system with a dynamic critical exponent larger than 1. Okay, so now let's first look at Green's function for a quantum critical point with z larger than 1 and decide how much we can say about the Green's function just by looking at the symmetry. We know that the frequency should scale this way and the momentum should scale this way. They have a different scaling power, and that power z is our critical dynamic critical exponent. By requiring that the Green's function is scaling invariant, we know that the Green's function must take this functional form. Okay? Here, mu is the scaling dimension of my boson, and k is momentum. This k to the power 2 mu z taking care of the dimension, the scaling dimension of my Green's function. And the last part, this curl g part, is a dimensionless arbitrary function. Okay? It's arbitrary function and it's scaling invariant. Omega hat inside the function there is a dimensionless quantity. It's omega over k to power z. Okay? So if we only look at the scaling symmetry, that's the best we can do. Okay? It takes this scaling functional form with an unknown arbitrary function. So to compute the Green's function is basically to compute the functional form for this unknown dimensionless function. So how do we determine this dimensionless function, g omega hat? Well, it turns out very nicely there is one way to compute this quantity using the gravity approach. Using the magic-like dictionary tells us how to connect quantities on the gravity side with quantities and physical observables on the field theory side. As a field theory person, this description is a bit beyond my expertise, but nevertheless, I will try to give a reasonable well description for the approach. So first of all, I introduce a gravity background. This gravity background is similar to the ADS space people typically use, but slightly different. We add one need to add an extra ingredient z, the critical exponent. Dynamic critical exponent here. Okay. Then one can introduce a probe boson and give this probe boson an equation of motion. Okay. When we solve this equation of motion, and this equation of motion actually can be solved very straightforwardly by doing a Fourier transform for the x and the t direction, not for the rho direction. And then this partial differential equation becomes a differential equation for rho only. Oh, and by the way, for simplicity, I define the quantity rho hat here, which is rho times k to power z. This is a dimensionless quantity. It's a dimensionless rho. Okay? So after this Fourier transform, the equation of motion becomes a Schrodinger-like equation. It's basically considering one quantum particle moving in effective potential. And this effective potential is uniquely determined by the scaling dimension of my bosonic field. Okay? Then we can take the rho equals zero and the rho equals infinite limit. The rho equals zero near the boundary, the asymptotic form of the solution is a power law function. It's actually two independent power law functions. And near the horizon, near the black hole, it actually gives plane waves for z larger than one. And here we need to take the so-called infalling boundary condition. It means the particle only goes into the black hole and not come out. If we fix the infalling boundary condition request b equals zero, then we can get a solution for this partial differential equation, and that solution determines the value for a and b. And for reasons that looks like magic to me, if one just calculates the ratio between a and b, we get the Green's function. Okay? That's the technique. So this is a gravity approach, but how does it compare with a field theory approach? Well, it seems, as I mentioned early on, from the field theory point of view, the Green's function for this type of critical system with z larger than one is not expected to be universal. If we only know the scaling dimension, we can't determine the Green's function uniquely. There is an arbitrary degree of freedom. However, this gravity approach seems to give a unique answer. If one follows the procedure, one gets a specific functional form of g omega hat, and there are no degree of freedom to adjust that. So it seems that the gravity side has some ingredient missing, does not allow us to capture the non-universal behavior of the Green's function. That's right, the bosonic field one is calculating, not just the scaling dimension of the bosonic field. So what I'm referring here is, if I only know the scaling dimension of a bosonic field, one can't determine the Green's function universally.
If you add non-minimal couplings, then you get something different.
Well, I'll come to that, actually, on the next slide, yes. Yes. So what are the missing ingredients? Okay, let's look at the procedures again. Okay, we introduce a gravity background and put a scalar boson and give an equation of motion for this boson. It turns out the at least part of the reason something is missing comes from this equation of motion. Okay, so if we have if we are studying a system with Lorentz symmetry, for a boundary with Lorentz symmetry, or a typical ADS system, this equation of motion is pretty much the only equation of motion we can write down. Okay? Because in that case, t, rho, and x have the same scaling dimension, they are the same theory relation, so their gradient should take exactly the same form. Okay, that's pretty much the only theory we can write down. But here, if we look at the gravity background, the gravity background tells us clearly rho and x are not equivalent, t and x are not equivalent. If rho and x are not equivalent, t and x are not equivalent, there's no reason they must take the same type of derivative in the equation of motion. So because this system has much lower symmetry, it has much smaller, much weaker constraint on the equation of motion. One can actually add additional derivatives to the equation of motion. If one do so, when I rewrite everything into this Schrodinger-like equation, this additional term, these additional derivative terms, introduce additional terms to the effective potential. Okay, and we can add actually infinite many terms here, in principle. Okay, because the potential is modified, the solution of the Schrodinger equation are modified, and the Green's function modified. So when we allow the equation of motion to follow the symmetry to get additional terms that does not violate this symmetry, then indeed the gravity side also tells us the Green's function is not uniquely determined by just the scaling dimension. Does this answer the question?
Sorry, but we never do this in general relativity. No, we never screw up the covariance of the equations of motion. So the metric will break certain symmetries, as you're saying now, it's not Lorentz invariant,
right.
And that will be the only effect, the only Lorentz relativity effect we allow to have in the equations of motion. No? Why are you changing the rules? What's the new agreement here?
So suppose we are doing things in flat space. If we have Lorentz symmetry, and we want to write down a theory for boson, this is pretty much the only theory, the equation of motion we can write down. But if we violate Lorentz symmetry, there are a bunch more different theory one can write down. For example, if we violate Lorentz symmetry and consider a Galilean wind system, definitely we get Schrodinger equation, not this one.
What is the gravity background that corresponds to this effective potential?
Gravity background. Actually, here it's a probe. It's a probe scalar. It does not feed back to the gravity background. Gravity background will also keep. It always keep it fixed like this.
But I assume that these extra terms come because you turned on say the derivative.
Right. The higher derivative terms in the equation of motion.
So it's the Lagrangian. It comes. Your Lagrangian contains higher order terms.
Right.
So, this is where these terms are coming from.
Exactly.
So you're not breaking the rules of the game. Right?
Exactly.
Well, presumably the terms which you would add in the bulk acting would still have to be something like dt of...
That's right. It's basically, they are the partial derivative terms. It's partial derivative terms. But right. Partial derivatives does not need to take this exact form.
Yeah, you can write general covariant.
Right.
Terms.
Right. It's still covariant derivative.
For this particular geometry, then that will give you
right.
Okay, so then
right.
What is the Lagrangian?
No,
okay.
No. I will just answer the principle.
I'm a little confused because the extra terms seem to define omega hat.
Right.
It's a ratio of vectors. It's not a local term. Omega hat is a ratio of momentum and frequency.
I believe.
So everything you add on the Lagrangian is local.
I believe we add is local, I believe. I can check that, but I'm not 100% sure about that. Yes. As I mentioned, this gravity approach is beyond my real expertise. And so here I will just demonstrate a principle that in principle, equation of motion could be more complicated. Okay. So since Green's function is not universally determined, and it seems to have agreement on gravity side and field theory arguments, but this agreement does not help us. It is not helpful. This is because for the study of theoretical physics, we want to focus on universal properties. We want to say something that is robust, does not depend on much of the details.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I want to ask
that. Sure.
Can you show the previous transparency?
Sure.
So that seems to have higher powers of omega hat.
Higher powers of omega hat.
Which is some ratio of omega and k.
Right.
So naively, I would think that if you add higher derivative terms, there would be higher derivative in both omega and k, not
right.
Not the ratio.
I believe this is because we rescaled the equation of motion. We divided k squared, k to some power for the equation of motion at the end of the day.
So there's an infinite number of extra terms you can add?
Right.
Still in the same scaling limit, and they're local? I find that hard to believe.
So an example, there'll be some vector that has a verb in this background. There's AT. So if you could write things like A mu, grad mu, phi,
yeah.
Those will give you DDT terms. In this
but those will not scale the same way as the original term.
Yeah, but if your equation have this kind of symmetry, then you can always write in, the, in this kind of variable.
You always get extra powers of omega and k. You're not getting extra powers of omega and k, right? You're only getting ratios.
So, for example, if we look at the scaling, because t and x have different scaling,
yes.
Derivative of t and derivative of x actually counts with different scaling.
I agree.
So, right. So when we have second order derivative for time, for example, here,
yeah.
Then automatically we should have fourth order derivative for space to keep
right.
the scaling dimension comparable.
Not anymore.
That's right.
From a local Lagrangian, I don't see that.
Okay, we can talk about this. This is something I need to think more about. This is something, yes, really beyond what I understand well. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the Green's function is not universal, but it turns out this system still has some universal properties. That universal properties turns out to be in the imaginary part of the Green's function. And in the imaginary part of the Green's function, it turns out there is one universal asymptotic form that remains pretty much universal regardless of detail of the theory. Okay, so before I discuss about the Z larger than one system, let's go back to the Z equals one case and ask what's going on for the for the simpler system with a Lorentz symmetry. Okay, so for the system with a Lorentz symmetry, if we look at some scalar boson and look at the Green's function, especially the imaginary part of the Green's function, we will find a light cone. Okay. Inside the light cone, when frequency is larger than momentum, the imaginary part is non-zero, but when you go outside the light cone, it becomes zero exactly. Okay. And we can study the asymptotic form like this. We can fix our momentum and try to go from high frequency down to low frequency. Okay. This is something we can do. We can try to figure out the asymptotic form of my imaginary part of the Green's function in this limit. And this asymptotic form is very simple. It's just zero, because once we go outside the light cone, everything is zero. This is not even a asymptotic form in the small omega limit. This is actually an exact form. Okay.
So your G is the Feynman
or? This is some of the boson and the retarded Green's function, imagine part of the retarded Green's function, the spectral function, or the scattering rate.
So, without even taking the imaginary part, in position space, it's zero.
So, if we repeat the same analysis for Z larger than one case, we don't have a light cone. We have actually a soft boundary. Okay, for example, if we consider z equals 2 critical points, we can define a soft boundary more or less following a k-squared curve, quadratic curve. And inside the soft boundary, the imaginary part is large, but once we go outside, imaginary part becomes small, but nevertheless non-zero. So as long as we stay away from the horizontal axis, from stay away from omega equals 0, the imaginary part is always there, never vanish. Okay? Okay, and if we try to go to the small omega limit, the same asymptotic form here, and one can show that this asymptotic form, this essential singularity behavior, is robust and doesn't seem to depend on any microscopic detail the system shows. Okay.
This is from holography.
Right. This is from holography. Yes. Thank you. And we can generalize this conclusion to, one can generalize the same conclusion for z larger than 1. And for z larger than 1, it's more or less the same essential singularity form, but with a slightly different power. Okay? And this one is also seems to be robust against the details of the theory. Okay. Let me see where it is. Okay, so how do we understand this asymptotic form? Again, let's look at z equals one case first. Simply z equals one case.
But does this behavior is violated by the earlier argument? you can multiply the
right.
operator by some arbitrary function.
That's a very good point.
Be true outside.
That's a very good point. But you know, the essential singularity is a very strong singularity. If I multiply it by any asymptotic, sorry, any analytic function, it's still an essential singularity.
Oh, you're saying the prefactor does not matter. Just talk about this.
Right, I'm talking about the asymptotic form. The essential singularity. Right. Yes, actually, you are right. So in front of this essential singularity, there could be other things. But when I go to the small omega limit, the other contribution changes much slower than this essential singularity.
Yeah, but if I want to be, I can also multiply functions.
Right.
This essential singularity.
That will cause problem for the definition of the field. You don't want to multiply a singular function to a field. The field become ill-defined.
Oh, but it's always a ratio.
It depends on what you mean by singular. It's always a ratio, right? Which one? So for example, the argument I discussed early on, where it is here, I multiplied a function to...
what do you mean by f is singular? Or if I have
an
exponential form, it's still not singular.
If it's an exponential form, it should not be a singular function of omega and k.
But this is always a ratio.
This function is a ratio, I agree with you. But there are physical constraints. If I multiply a singular function for omega and k, when you translate it to real space, the object will not be local anymore.
Then what is your... I see.
So one can multiply by any smooth varying function, and everything smooth is okay.
You say that function has to be regular when you take both omega and k to zero or something, or separate to zero. What is the definition of singular or
not singular? At least it should not contain essential singularity. If it contains essential singularity, the field is ill-defined at that point. The quantum operator itself will become ill-defined in the small omega limit. In most of the case, we assume everything is smooth and every physical observable is smooth, and so we can analyze that. Okay. So let's go back to the z equals 1 case and ask why this imaginary part of the Green's function outside the light cone is 0. Okay. Of course, the ultimate answer to this question is the Lorentz symmetry. The Lorentz symmetry tells us it's impossible for the imaginary part outside the light cone to be non-zero. Okay. But here I will take a slightly different approach. And in this slightly different approach, I will get the same conclusion at this using a slightly different approach. Okay. Let's consider a Dirac fermion. So here I write down a Dirac fermion in 2 plus 1D. Actually, the dimensionality here is not important. We can do the same analysis for different dimensions, but let's do the analysis here in 2 plus 1D. Okay? So my psi is a two-component spinner, and I have gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2. That's my three gamma matrices. And this is a linear derivative in space and time, and a full fermion short-range interaction term. Okay? That's a theory I will be considering. And then I introduce a scalar boson. Because it's a boson, it can only couple to fermion like this. That's a coupling between boson and the fermion. And I ask, what is the Green's function for this bosonic field? Okay. And the imaginary part of the Green's function, we know the physical meaning of this is the decay rate. It tells us how fast this boson can decay into other particles. And if this boson cannot decay at all, then the imaginary part should be zero. If we can find the decay channel for this boson, then it will be non-zero. Okay? So to determine whether the imaginary part of the Green's function is zero or not, we just need to look at the decay channel of this boson. Okay? So how do we determine whether the decay is possible or not? Well, the answer is very simple. We just need to look at some conservation laws. So here is the energy and the momentum conservation. Okay, so for a boson with energy omega and the momentum k, when we decay it into a particle and an antiparticle, momentum need to be conserved and energy need to be conserved. Okay? It turns out by requiring the momentum and energy conservation law, we can realize immediately for a fixed momentum k, the boson energy need to be larger than k to have a decay, which preserves energy and momentum. Okay? To see that, let's look at the dispersion relation of a Dirac electron. So this is a dispersion relation of Dirac electron. I will use the Dirac C picture. So I will occupy the negative energy state by electron, or all of them by electrons. And the positive energy state will remain empty. So this is a ground state. If we send in a boson with energy omega and momentum k, it will kick some electron from the negative energy state to the positive energy state, create a particle and antiparticle pair. And of course, we need to satisfy momentum conservation. So this horizontal vector need to match the momentum of my boson. This vertical line need to match the energy of my boson. Okay? And if we fix the momentum of my boson and change the energy, we find that there is a minimum, there is a smallest minimum bound for the energy. The energy of this particle-hole pair cannot be smaller than momentum. Okay? This minimum bound is reached when I equally distribute the momentum of my boson into my particle and the antiparticle. So half of momentum go to particle, half of momentum go to antiparticle. In this case, the excitation of my particle and antiparticle, the energy is omega. It matches precisely the k. For any other arrangement, energy can only be larger, but never smaller than this quantity. Okay? So there is a lower bound. So if we consider the boson decay into a particle and antiparticle pair, this is a lower bound. Energy must be above the momentum. So this is what we call the particle-hole continuum in condensed matter physics. Okay, how about higher order decays? Because we have interactions between fermions, we can decay the boson further into higher number of particle and hole pairs, particle and antiparticle pairs. For example, if we introduce a four fermion vortex here, we can decay into two particles and two holes. Okay? That's what we can, that's another possible decay channel. And furthermore, we can do this in three particle and three hole channel, n particle and n hole channel in general. Okay? And we can repeat the same analysis and ask if we fix the momentum, is there a lower bound for energy to satisfy momentum and energy conservation law? It turns out there is always a lower bound for all the decay channel, and all of them share the same lower bound. The lower bound is omega larger than k. Okay, it's the same. That not depends on decay channel.
There can be bound states.
Huh? There can
be bound states.
States
of
part
of the whole pair
when
energy
rises. Still have a relativity.
The bound state between particle and the hole.
This algebra you've done, I don't think this.
Look, I mean, you can just think of any one of those particles, any one of those particles of the bound state.
Right.
It still has the same relativistic dispersion.
Right. Every single particle has the same dispersion, same linear dispersion. So at the end of the day.
If it has a mass, that only makes the mass.
Right. Mass can make it even larger.
Yes.
But one can never reduce it. So this is really the minimum bound. So once you create those particles, you are cost this energy. Then when you bound them together, it will not be able to further reduce energy. Okay. So all the diagrams have the same lower bound. So this tells us if my energy is below my momentum, it's impossible for the particle to decay, so the imaginary part of the Green's function must be exactly zero if we go outside the light cone. Okay? And this is true even for infinite order in diagrammatic expansions. No way to violate this. Of course, the reason for all the different channels to share the same boundary is because of the Lorentz symmetry. Okay? But there is another way to understand why all the different channels share the same boundary. That is because the z equals 1 Dirac system has a linear dispersion relation. Okay? So same as the two particle, one particle, one hole situation. So in any of this decay channel, the minimum energy is reached when we equally distribute the momentum between all the particles and antiparticles. Okay? If we have n particle and n antiparticle, and we want the total momentum k to be distributed equally among those particles, each one of them get momentum k over 2n. Okay? So that's the momentum of one particle. And the energy of one particle, because it's a linear dispersion relation, the energy of one particle is the same. Okay. Then we have 2n particle and hole together. So the total energy is 2n times this guy. And 2n got canceled. So n doesn't matter. Okay. So the crucial thing here is this dispersion relation is linear. If it's a linear function, this 2n would got canceled, so the energy they will become independent of the particle and the whole number, but this will no longer be true if we have a nonlinear dispersion relation. Okay, so this is another way to understand why there is a light cone in system with Lorentz symmetry. So now let's try to do the same for system with z larger than 1. Okay, let's start from z equals 2. So first of all, if we want to do the same, we need a model similar to the Dirac theory. And that can actually be achieved by considering a model, a quadratic band touching point model. So let's start from the same Dirac theory I write down early on. And then let's introduce some motivation to this Dirac theory. So the most important modification here is for the gamma 1 and gamma 2 terms, in the original Dirac theory, we have first order spatial derivatives. Here, let's substitute it by some second order derivatives. Okay. So, and I require the second order derivative to have this D wave symmetry pattern, partial x squared minus partial y squared, and partial x times partial y. Okay. So this is the modification to gamma 1 and gamma 2 terms. And because this system does not have Lorentz symmetry, we can actually introduce a couple more terms to the theory. For example, we can introduce a second order derivative terms of space to gamma 0. Okay? In Dirac theory, gamma 0 can only be multiplied to time derivative. But now, because we don't have Lorentz symmetry anymore, we can actually introduce another second-order spatial derivative here inside gamma 0. Okay. And the physical meaning of this term is it violates the particle and antiparticle symmetry. If we don't have this term, when we compute the band structure for this the dispersion relation for this theory, we find that it's pretty much the same as the Dirac point, but the dispersion relation near the Dirac point is proportional to k squared. It's a second order. Okay. It's a quadratic dispersion. And without this T0 term, particle and antiparticle band participate will have the same energy, just differs by a minus sign. But if we introduce this T0 here, positive energy state and negative energy state will no longer be related. Okay? The quadratic dispersion relation, the curvature, will become different between particle band and antiparticle states. And there is another new ingredient in this construction, in this modified model, that is another control parameter, which we call T1. Okay? This control parameter is a coefficient for the gamma 1 term. And this coefficient for the gamma 1 term, it was not allowed for the Dirac theory. In the Dirac theory, gamma 1 and gamma 2 term have the same coefficient. If they don't have the same coefficient, then we can rescale x out y to absorb the coefficient. But here, in this theory, there is no way to absorb this T1. So this T1 is really a control parameter. The physical meaning of this T1 is it controls the rotational symmetry, the space rotational symmetry. If T1 is 1, then the system has SO2 rotational symmetry. All the different directions are the same. If T1 differs by 1, then this system where the symmetry will reduce to C4. It will only have four-fold rotational symmetry, no longer continuum rotational symmetry. Okay. So now let's consider, there are a couple of more comments I want to give for this particular model. So if we compare this model with the Dirac fermion, there's one major difference. For Dirac fermion, we always have a fermion doubling problem. Namely, if we want to write, for example, a Dirac theory in any lattice with a proper cutoff, we find that Dirac points always appear in pairs. It's impossible to get a single one. But this type of quadratic band touching point is not limited by fermion doubling. We could have only one of them in our whole system. And one can prove that similar to a Dirac theory, if we enforce some symmetry, like time reversal or chiral symmetry, then the mass term for this fermion need to be zero all the time. the mass term is prohibited. So this means as long as we preserve these symmetries, the system will remain critical all the time. And in addition to the time reversal and the chiral symmetry, we also need to enforce some rotational symmetry to our system, either fourfold or sixfold or continuum SO2 rotational symmetry. This is because if we don't enforce this rotational symmetry, a quadratic band touching point will split into two Dirac points. If we don't have this symmetry, we can introduce additional perturbations to the action. If we do that, it splits the quadratic band touching point, and we go back to the z equals 1 case. Okay, so in lattice models, this type of band touching point actually exists in many, many different lattices. This one is a checkerboard lattice. This one is Emery, also called the Lib lattice. And this lattice is the same lattice we use to study high-TC superconductors. And for these two lattices, we have one quadratic band touching point in its band structure if we put the Hopping strength in the proper range. And this is a Kagome lattice. Depending on how many electrons we put in this lattice, we will get either one quadratic band touching point or two Dirac points. And the lower left corner is bilayer graphene. It's a real material. It's basically two layers of graphene. It's widely studied in experiments. And this guy turns out to have two quadratic band touching points in its band structure. And the same type of band structure, quadratic band touching point, can be also seen in square lattice. If we allow each square site to have multiple atomic orbitals, then we can get either one quadratic band touching point or two quadratic band touching point, depending on the control parameters. Okay, so that's all about the free particle dispersion relation. Now let's look at the interaction part. If we add a short-range interaction, or fermion interaction, to this theory, the first thing we can do is a simple dimension counting. If we do a dimension counting, we find that the frequency count as dimension 2, momentum count as dimension 1, wave function has dimension d over 2, d is the spatial dimension, and the coupling constant has dimension 2 minus d. Okay? This tells us the critical dimension of this theory is d equals 2. In 2 plus 1d, my coupling constant will be dimensionless on the tree level. So if we compare it with Dirac theory, the coupling constant has dimension 1 minus d. Okay, here is 2 minus d. So for Dirac theory, the critical dimension is 1. So 1 plus 1d Dirac theory and 2 plus 1d quadratic band touching theory actually has the same type of scaling behavior on the tree level. But that analogy only remains on the tree level. If we go beyond the tree level, this analogy will be gone immediately. For the 1 plus 1D Dirac system, we know everything will remain exactly marginal. There is no RG flow, nothing flows at all, because 1 plus 1D Dirac system has conformal symmetry. And because it's 1 plus 1D, the conformal group is so large, it fixes everything. Nothing can flow. But this 2 plus 1D quadratic band touching point model, there is no conformal symmetry. And of course, there is no 1 plus 1D conformal symmetry groups. So we do have RG flow. And the RG flow is very simple in 2 plus 1D. If we flow to IR, the coupling constant G flows infinite if G is larger than 0 for repulsive interactions. For attractive interactions, when we flow to IR, it becomes weaker and weaker. Okay, so this means if we introduce repulsive interaction to the system and try to cool down the system to very low temperature means IR fixed point, then the system will experience some instability because the coupling constant will blow up to infinite. And when the coupling constant blows up to infinite, it means the system will have some instability and leads to some phase transition, spontaneously break some symmetries. And there are two possible symmetry breaking channels in this model. One of them breaks the time reversal symmetry. If the time reversal symmetry is spontaneously broken, then we get a so-called topological insulator. It's a quantum oscillator, actually. And this phase transition, it's in the Ising universality class. It breaks a discrete time reversal symmetry. And after symmetry breaking, in the symmetry breaking phase, the fermion becomes massive. It's basically the spontaneous symmetry breaking induces mass to this fermion. And typically, this type of symmetry breaking pattern is favored when the coupling is weak, in the weak coupling regime. Another possibility is to break the rotational symmetry. And then it will give us a so-called nematic phase. So this nematic phase from the symmetry point of view is the same as the nematic phase we discussed yesterday. The only difference here is this nematic phase has zero fermion density, but the case we discussed yesterday has a Fermi surface, so it has a finite fermion density. Okay, this phase transition to the nematic phase could be Ising, could be in the Ising universality class. It could be in the U1 universality class, depending on the details of the model. And after symmetry breaking, the fermion could be massive, could be Dirac massless, depending on the details of the model. Okay? And typically, this type of situation is favored when coupling constant is large. If we require our model to have the U1 universality class for this phase transition, and we require the model to, such that the symmetry breaking side has massless fermions, then one can show from gravity and the field theory calculation that the symmetry breaking side, symmetry breaking phase, has a strange scaling behavior, namely momentum in the y direction and the frequency and the same scaling dimension q, and the momentum in the x direction have a different scaling dimension p. Okay. So the repulsive interaction, as I explained, will introduce some instability. So today, in my talk, I will mostly focus on the attractive interaction side. For the attractive interaction side, we know that it flows towards zero and IR. So in IR, it will not disrupt my quadratic band touching points, and I can pretty much do most of the calculation based on free theory. Okay. So because here, the quadratic band touching point is stable, one thing I can do is I introduce a fermion and ask what this fermion, what is the Green's function for this fermion, okay? And couple these fermions to my, I can introduce a boson and ask what is the Green's function for this boson. This boson could be an additional scalar field one added to the theory, or one could use one of the fermion bilinears. So the first one is density. The second two are the pneumatic order parameter for the pneumatic phase. The last one is order parameter for the topological insulator phase. That's four fermion bilinears one can write down in this model. So regardless of the dimension, let's consider a boson coupled to this quadratic band touching point fermion model. Okay? Same as Dirac theory, if we have the ground state and send in a boson, this boson will kick some occupied negative energy state electron to positive state and create a particle pair. Okay, and this particle hole pair, if we fix momentum and vary the energy of my boson, we find that there is energy minimum. And the energy minimum is k squared over 2. This energy minimum is also reached when I equally distribute my momentum of my boson, half to the particle, half to the antiparticle. Okay. So if we consider one particle and one hole decay, this is a boundary. Omega needs to be larger than k squared over 2. If we consider n particle and n hole decay, then the boundary actually changes. The boundary is omega larger than k squared over 2n. So this is exactly the opposite of the Dirac theory. The Dirac theory tells us the boundary does not depend on decay channel. All decay channels have the same boundary. Here, this decay channel has a 1 over n dependence for the number of particle and holes, particle and antiparticles we decay into. So why is that? This is exactly the same reason I explained early on. For Dirac, because of the linear dispersion relation, 2n and 2n got canceled. Here, because we have a quadratic dispersion relation, when the momentum is k over 2n, the energy of my particle is k over 2n squared. Once I squared here, the 2n squared cannot be canceled by the 2n. I will have a 2n left in the denominator. It's basically a result that the dispersion relation is not linear. Okay. So we can plot this boundary. If we want to decay into one particle and one antiparticle, the top curve here is the boundary. It can only happen above that top curve. If we want to decay into two particles and two holes, the second curve is a boundary. Okay. Three particles and three holes, the third curve is a boundary, etc. Okay. And if we go to infinite particle and infinite hole into extremely high order decay, this boundary will become flat and flatter, eventually it merge with the horizontal axis. Okay. This means no matter how low the energy I goes to, I can always find a decay channel. Okay. If I go to very low energy, I just need to decay into more particle and hole pairs. Because I can always find a decay channel, the imaginary part of the Green's function is never zero. Okay. It's always finite. Unless frequency is zero, there is always a decay channel. And this seems to be consistent with what gravity theory tells us. The imaginary part is non-zero for the whole momentum and the frequency range, except and frequency equals zero. Okay, so furthermore, we can also see that if we go to lower and lower frequency, we need to go to higher and higher decay channel. Okay, we need to go to higher and higher order decay. And those higher decay channel has much smaller probability. Because they have smaller probability in the higher order decay channel, and at low frequency, the decay probability will be small. That's also consistent with a gravity approach. Okay, that's qualitatively agreed. So let's try to do something better than qualitative agreed. Let's try to push to the quantitative level. Okay. So for to push to the quantitative level, let's look at the decay rate for different decay channels. If we want the boson to decay into one particle and one hole, this is actually a zeroth order decay. It does not require any fermion interactions. So G is my fermion, four fermion interaction strength. This guy does not depend on G, so it's proportional to G power zero. If I want the boson to decay into two particles and two holes, I need one fermion vortex. So the decay rate is proportional to G square. The reason we need a square is because this diagram is a decay amplitude. We need to mode square it to get the decay rate. That's why there is power two. If we want to decay into n particle and n hole, we will need more fermion vortices, and the power is g to the power 2n minus 1. Okay? So high order decay has smaller probability. It's a power law function of the coupling strength. Okay, now we already know that the boundary for the decay channel n is omega larger than k squared over 2n. Now we can ask the question, if we go to a really low frequency and I ask what is a possible decay channel, and I just need to invert this relation and show that n must be larger than k squared over 2 omega. Okay. If I go to low omega, I must go to very high n to have a possible decay, and this n needs to be larger than k squared over 2 omega. So this means for a fixed k and omega, when omega is small, the dominant decay channel is actually k squared over 2 omega. This is the leading order decay channel in this frequency range. Okay. So the decay probability is coupling constant to power 2 n, and this number n is proportional to 1 over omega. So let's substitute this n by 1 over omega. We got coupling constant to power g squared over omega. Okay. So that's how 1 over omega arises in the power of some in the power and forms the essential singularity. This object, if we convert it to an exponential function, this gives us precisely the essential singularity formalism one expected from the gravity calculation. One can repeat the same construction for z larger than 1 or larger than 2. If we go through a general construction for general z, we find that as long as z is larger than 1, and to the end of the day, the same argument will produce this functional form. And this functional form is, again, in good agreement with what gravity theory predicted. Okay, and the conclusion is actually also model independent. If we consider a different model, for example, we can consider the quantum Lipschitz model. This is a bosonic model. It's similar to Klein-Gordon. The only difference is we substitute the first order derivative in space by second order derivative. And this one is also a z equals 2 system at a critical point. And one can show that the free boson propagator is omega 1 over omega squared minus k to the power 4. If we introduce interactions, then this boson can decay. This boson can decay into 3 bosons in the leading order decay channel, or 5 bosons in the second order decay channel, or 7 bosons, etc. It can decay into any odd number of bosons. And if we look at the decay channel for 2n plus 1 bosons, we have energy and momentum conservation law. We can do the same construction to show that there is also energy minimum to satisfy energy and momentum conservation law. This energy minimum is also proportional to 1 over n. in the large n limit. And for the same reason, when we go to smaller and smaller omega, we need to go to higher and higher n. And this n is proportional to k squared over omega. And if we go through the same analysis, we find the same essential singularity behavior. Okay? So this conclusion is not very surprising, because when I derive this relation, I didn't assume any microscopic detail. The only thing I assume here is energy and momentum conservation law, and there is a nonlinear dispersion relation. Okay? So that's why we expect it to be universal, and then depends on much of the detail of the system.
So what determines, is it constant in the
differential? Constant?
Yeah.
That's basically, roughly speaking, the coupling constant G, the log of coupling constant G.
So that's
something not universal. That's something not universal.
But you put some limit on that constant?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. For example, if we look at the RG flow of the quadratic band touch model I discussed early on, when we start from some attractive interaction here, when we flow to IR, this coupling constant actually flows towards zero. Okay? So because of this RG procedure, this G itself is also supposed to be a function of K and omega, right? And the asymptotic limit we considered here, let me try to find a figure showing the asymptotic limit. Here, is to fix a K and try to go to small omega, okay? If we really go to zero omega and zero K, the RG flow tells me G is zero, G flows to zero. But the asymptotic formula we considered here fix the K flow to this point. So G itself, because our RG flow, it depends on K and omega. So the precise question one should ask is, what is the coupling constant when we flow towards this point, when we go to this point, when we go to this particular K? It depends on K. So it will really be highly non-universal. I don't know whether there is a bound or not, but the value itself would be highly non-universal. It depends on which K one tries to go down, along which path. But nevertheless, when one have a fixed K, it's a constant. But the number, we cannot, we really don't have.
But holographically, that's a constant, it does not depend on.
No, right. But that's somehow because this interaction is combined development. I mean, if you had a fixed point with a finite coupling,
that's right.
Then this would be an honest constant.
Right? That's right, that's right.
That's a true Lipschitz point, but then maybe that would be a better model, not a simpler model.
That's possible, that's possible. I don't know the answer, but that's possible. Okay, so where are we? Okay, I think I reached the last slides of my talk. Okay, so let me conclude. So basically, what we noted, I'm trying to convince you today is that for the Z larger than one quantum critical system, the physics is much more diversified, and scaling dimension is not sufficient to fix the functional form of physical observables, because we don't have Lorentz and we don't have conformal symmetry. However, in this asymptotic form, in this asymptotic limit where omega is dramatically smaller than k, the imaginary part of the Green's function seems to have some universal properties, and these universal properties, from a field theory point of view, it reflects the fact that energy and momentum need to be conserved. And I think I will stop here, and thank you for your attention.
Have you thought at all about, I mean, it would be really nice to have a more formal field theory derivation. I mean, maybe it's truly universal. I mean, you know, numbers are, you know, using, I don't know, I guess the algebra is not very big in this case, but somehow using the symmetry algebra, what identities, people, there's room to do this better than me, but, you know, unitarity,
right.
Etc. Is there any chance, maybe this is a question to you guys, any chance of deriving something like
this? This type of formula sometimes appear when, say you assume the scaling symmetry enhanced to some form of conformal, non-relative conformal symmetry. Saying z equals 2, right, you can do that. And I think you get formulas that look a bit like that. You can really constrain more than the two-point functions if you have some conformal symmetry.
And so maybe something that you can do at small omega. I mean, not in general, of course, but it's maybe a small omega. There's some way to say there's some sort of enhanced algebra, at least a small omega, that you can use to get that on the nose.
Right. It will be extremely useful, even just some specific limit, if it's coming.
What happens when for z equals 2, when you do get an enhanced symmetry? There, you know, you can do
right,
that.
Right. So, for example, if I have like the Galilean invariant, the Galilean symmetry, then there, things become universal again. If a system with Galilean invariants, then we'll have a hard boundary, that's a K square. Inside the boundary imaging part is non-zero. If you go outside, it's zero.
Exactly. I'm talking about the z equals to conformal algebra. I think you might get that if you use a conformal generator.
Using a conformal generator for
yeah.
So for
the Green function to demand that the Green function also have to be satisfied. You might get it for z equals. For c different from 2, maybe at omega much less than k, you can try to argue there's an enhancement of the algebra. People try this and, of course, fail at omega finite.
We also tried a bit about trying to use certain word identities, but didn't find a successful story. And the asymptotic, essential singularity is something really hard to.
I mean, for the Fermi surface case, which is also non z is 3/2 or something, I don't think this is.
That's right. I totally agree.
That's right.
There are additional assumptions. If I introduce any Fermi surface, then things will be totally different. This is not for the theory of everything. It's for only for certain cases. I think for the field theory calculation and the gravity calculation, so far we did, we both assume the fermion density is zero. There's no fermion in the system. And definitely, if I want fermion, things will be totally different.
When your argument is a weak coupling argument.
That's right.
On the field theory side.
That's right. So it's a weak coupling limit. It's a non-perturbative weak coupling limit. Although it's non-perturbative, but you are totally right. It's a weak coupling.
Yeah, so at the beginning you said that without Lorentz invariants you have more freedom because you can redefine your operators
right.
And the powers of k.
Right.
But on the other hand, I mean, if you work in position space, that redefinition of an operator maps a local operator to a non-local, not to something that is not a local operator. So maybe if you impose locality at some level, you can get further constraints, no?
Right, certainly those F function is not arbitrary function. One need to guarantee everything is local. That's why I mentioned early on, we don't want to want the F function itself to contain essential singularity.
Yeah, but then because every function will be a non-local, right?
Yeah, because you have inverse power.
Any non-trivial function will be non-local. If it's f is not equal to 1, it would be non-local.
If f,
because if you have positive
you
powers
have
of k, you have negative powers
have
of omega, so you are either non-local in space or in time.
So I think one could push I definitely agree there would be a singular point for this function and certain a certain value of omega hat we defined. But I think we can push, for some function, we can push this singular point to away from the real axis to the imaginary plane.
But if you're willing to change the scaling dimension of the field, of course you can make something local. You can put omegas and k's on top, and then compare something that you thought was universal with something else, and that will be different.
Yeah. But if you want to keep the same dimension, seems like whatever function you modify in momentum space, we are always.
But I think just as an idea of an argument that you cannot have something that you can have whatever you want. You can assume the same, have something universal, and then you create a new field that's something local with some derivatives, and then that thing will have a different dispersion relation from it. It would change for the dimension, but it would generate a new form. And then that's it. That's
right.
A local thing.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I don't agree. So suppose you take, suppose z is equal to 2, no? You take k square over omega times the operator, and then you say, now let me cure that omega by taking a time derivative.
Now, I'm saying you can take like omega square minus k to some power. That's local. Okay, up to funky powers. That's more local than the other thing.
Yeah. So. For example, one construct an object like this. So for the small omega and large omega limit, small k and a larger k limit, it's all reasonably well defined.
But the question is this still a local operator? It's not the local operator, right?
Let me think. I think one would be able to take at least a local part from this type of construction.
I mean, it has a local expansion. Let's say small omegas, but it's not a local operator before down to arbitrary short timescales.
That's right. But you know, in reality, in condensed matter system, we can't go to really short timescales. Other things will happen.
Yeah,
but even if it was more omega expansion, it's the infinite sum
which
is
k in the downstairs.
Still
not the local,
but
it's not local in space.
Yeah,
not local in space.
This quantity is local in space, right? If we just multiply the k to the fourth upstairs, is it just a fourth order derivative term?
Mm-hmm.
Side, meaning if you're expanding for small omega for small k, in either case you'll
be right, local. That's right.
In either case you'll be not local in the other variety.
It cannot be both local.
It cannot be both local in time and space.
That's right. I agree.
May I suggest that we we take this offline? Any last questions unrelated? Well, then let's thank the speaker again.